I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to the Midday News Wrap. It's been 3.5 months since the election, but President Donald Trump can't seem to stop campaigning. Thousands greeted him in Melbourne, Florida last Saturday night for a rally paid for by his campaign, and this morning he made a campaign-style speech at the CPAC meeting. Thousands have taken to the streets around the country in protest. Trump is signing executive orders at the speed of light, gleefully attacking his to-do list of campaign promises. In Baltimore, the group trying to rehab the aging State Center complex has taken to the airwaves to get Governor Hogan back to the bargaining table. Mayor Pugh says she has a plan for Baltimore schools, and Maryland has a snow shortfall that may set a record. Alec McGillis of ProPublica and Gene Marbella of the Baltimore Sun join me on the Midday News Wrap right after the news. And good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you're joining us for the Midday News Wrap. The Trump administration is 5 weeks old today, and true to form, there's never a dull moment. His solo press conference in week four was, depending on your political persuasion, either freewheeling and refreshing or out of control and terrifying. You might say that week five was calmer for President Trump than weeks one through four, or has this presidency, as some have suggested, simply become normalized, even though many people think that this White House is anything but. There were new guidelines on immigration, a reversal of Obama directives for schools concerning bathrooms for transgender students, and a lot of heated talk at numerous town hall meetings about repealing the ACA. The president insists that the disruptive crowds are paid by liberal groups, but there's no evidence that the people showing up to speak out against the repeal of Obamacare aren't anyone but people who have come to depend and rely on the Affordable Care Act. Joining me today for the Midday News Wrap, Gene Marbella. She's been a writer and editor at the Baltimore Sun for 30 years. She is currently on the Sun's investigative and enterprise team. She has been a feature writer, a national correspondent, and a columnist, covering stories like the Olympics and 9/11, as well as local events too numerous to enumerate. Gene, good to see you.
Nice to be here.
30 years seems like a long time, however. Let me remind listeners. let me remind folks, you were hired when you were 10.
A child prodigy,
you know, the smartest third grader in the school. Alec McGillis is here as well. He covers politics and government for ProPublica. He was part of a team that won the Pulitzer Prize when he was working at the Baltimore Sun. And last year, he won the Robin Toner Prize for Excellence in Political Reporting. And earlier this week, he was awarded a prestigious George Polk Award for national reporting during the presidential campaign. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, and elsewhere. Al, congratulations on the award. It's a big darn deal. It's terrific.
Oh, thank you. It's a real honor.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you're here and glad you won it. You are welcome to join and weigh in on our conversation here. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, if you want to drop us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. So, Alec, let's talk a little bit about the series of pieces that you wrote that led to this this Polk Award. You wrote one called "The Revenge of the Middle Class" or the Forgotten Class.
Yes.
And just this morning at CPAC, President Trump, you know, repeated his oft repeated campaign line that said, you know, the forgotten men and women of America will be forgotten no longer. I mean, his address at CPAC and honor. Did you guys get a chance to listen to it at all?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was straight out of the campaign. I mean, this could have been a speech he was given in October. It was the same bullet points, you know, veterans and jobs and all of that stuff. But what did you find? I mean, were there common elements among the folks that you talked to in terms of those who were so disaffected that they decided to support Mr. Trump?
Definitely. I mean, I was not that surprised by the outcome, or at least one part of the outcome, by that surge of support that he got from this, you know, this white working class, because I was seeing it all year. I was mainly talking to people in Ohio for some pieces I was doing there. And what I was finding was all these things that seem sort of hard to believe. A lot of people who had voted for Barack Obama once or twice who were telling me that they were going to vote for Donald Trump, which is extraordinary. It seemed extraordinary to conceive of that. And then I also kept finding people who had never voted before, people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s who had never voted before ever and were coming out of the woodwork to vote for Donald Trump. And of course, those are just the kind of people who were not being picked up in the polling models, which would help explain why the polls were off in some of these places.
Because those polls were likely voters.
Likely voters.
And these were unlikely voters,
right,
if they'd never voted before.
They're based on past behavior. And what sort of held these places together, the common bond between these places where these voters were, is that they are places that have been left behind. I mean, one of the great sort of, I think, overlooked stories of our time is not just inequality among sort of the 1% and the 99% and the personal income inequality, but it's regional inequality, the huge gaps that have opened up between places. We have these places that are doing extraordinarily well, these sort of bubbles of prosperity like Washington and New York and San Francisco and Seattle, where the economy is kind of concentrated in these sort of winner-take-all places. And then you have these other places that have been left behind. You'd think things would even out a bit more because we can be anywhere these days with the internet and all that. But it hasn't happened. Instead, you've got this sort of snowball effect. It's a winner-take-all effect. The rich places get richer, and these other places are very aware of that, and the resentment just grows and grows.
Jay Marbella, Alec uses a phrase that everybody uses, which is, these folks feel that they have been left behind. What does that mean? Behind what? I mean, who exactly has ignored them? Who exactly has decided, okay, we're going to forget about you and concentrate on somebody else?
Right. I think, a lot of it is economic. These are blue-collar workers in some respects, and their factories closed. They didn't close in the last 8 years. They closed a long time ago. But, I think it's this buildup. And I think there's also this sort of feeling of being kind of sociologically left behind, in a sense. I come from the Midwest, and I have brothers-in-law who are Trump supporters and are just, and for them, and they're doing fine. They've been employed their entire lives. One's a blue-collar guy. One's a very well-educated engineer. But what they just bristle over the political correctness that they feel has taken over the media, which, I come to represent for all of them. And they just felt liberated by Trump, that now they could say what was on their mind and no one was going to say, oh, come on, don't be rude or don't be, politically incorrect. And so I think, there's some real economic angst, but there's also this sort of psychological, sociological, sense of being like, always being told what to think and who to praise and who not to praise. And I think there is just this, finally someone has said it's okay to, be for your own people and not those people in the city or those people on the coast.
Or those people who are a different color, or those people, right, who are a different religion, or those people, who are different in any way. I mean, Alec, you're right about that these are all these folks who, and I think it fascinates people to think that you could vote for Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012, and then vote for Donald Trump, because they are politically so far apart. So they're voting for Obama for non-political reasons. I mean, it wasn't his agenda that attracted them. You just think, well, if you're a Democrat, if you're, inclined to have a view that includes, some government involvement in the lives of the body politic, you're going to go for an Obama or a Hillary Clinton. If you're not, if you think we're overregulated and the government is this albatross on your back, you're going to go for a Mitt Romney or a John McCain or a Donald Trump. But that's hard to explain still, I think, how someone could switch from a Barack Obama to a Donald Trump.
It is hard to explain, but my sense of it is that it's about who's the person who's for change. If you're really not happy with things, and then you want the guy who's for change. In 2008, that was Barack Obama. I mean, he represented change in such a dramatic way, and there was like a movement behind him. And so people got on that movement. This year, the change guy, the movement guy, was Donald Trump. So that was part of it. Part of it was that really was also about Hillary Clinton. We shouldn't forget that there was another candidate in this race that people were choosing Donald Trump over. And a lot of the people I spoke with were not so enamored of Donald Trump. They saw a lot of his flaws and they had their worries about him, but they just couldn't stand Hillary Clinton. And this was not just men, it was also a lot of women. I spoke to white working class women. And of course, there's all sorts of things wrapped up in that. There's misogyny, there's sexism, but that the antipathy to Hillary cannot be overstated. In 2012, after Obama's kind of, you know, chain sheen had worn off, the way he got people still to vote for him against Mitt Romney in these places was that he persuaded people that he was still the guy who was on your side. He was on your side and not that private equity guy, Mitt Romney. This year, Hillary Clinton failed to do that. She was unable to persuade people that she was the one who was on your side. People saw Donald Trump as the one who was more on their side. So it, really, I think you always have to keep in mind, this was not just about Trump. It was also about Hillary, who turned out to be a uniquely ill-fitted candidate for this year.
Yeah, good point. Jay Marbella, I mean, in his address to CPAC today, the Conservative Political Action Committee, which is being held at Harbor Point or Harbor, or whatever it's called,
National
Harbor,
Harbor
right here in Maryland. He brought up the fact that these forgotten men and women who will be forgotten no longer were called deplorable by Hillary Clinton, you know, and Mitt Romney had his, you know, big gaffe in the campaign, and Hillary Clinton had that one, and it was certainly a big one. And they immediately started chanting, lock her up, just like the convention, just like all of those rallies. And Trump declared that GOP was going to become the party of the American worker. He said, we all bleed the same red blood. And then, you know, he finished to great applause, and they played the choir singing, you can't always get what you want, which I'll never understand. It's a campaign rally song. But generally speaking, this past week seems to have been somewhat calmer for the president, at least by my reckoning. Do you think, what's different about week five than weeks one through four?
You know, someone must have taken his phone away yesterday. I think for 2 days, there had only been one or two tweets. And then he was back today with, I guess, a tweet slamming the FBI for leaking to reporters. So I guess that didn't last very long. You know, I think maybe I'm just being optimistic, but I just don't think this is sustainable, you know, to create this much chaos over, you know, these executive orders that come flying out of the White House with no discernible policy underneath it or no discernible plan for how you're going to actually enact it. I mean, it's exhausting. And I just don't think, you know, I think it works. It suits sort of the Steve Bannons and, you know, his crew who are all about creating chaos, you know, because they come from the blogosphere or whatever you want to call Breitbart. But you can't run a government that way. At a certain point, people will just be like, well, what's happening?
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of folks think that, Alec, but maybe you can run a government this way because that's what the president is doing, isn't he?
Yeah, I think that I think 4 days, it wasn't even a full week, right? We had the 3 day weekend. So I think I wouldn't read too much in the fact that they were able to kind of keep things under wraps for these few days. It's very possible that we're going to see more chaos in weeks to come. And it's also worth noting, of course, that even while this week seemed more calm and in sort of a superficial way of, you know, fewer tweets and whatnot, that for a lot of people in this country, this was probably the worst week yet of the presidency because of all the complete fear and chaos that his immigration orders have put into play.
This is
really, in some sense, the most consequential week that we've had yet at the administration. This is the first week where you're seeing just the incredible ramifications and consequence of Donald Trump winning this election for millions of real people in this country who are now scrambling in terror, really.
I don't know if this happens to you guys, but it certainly happens to me with regularity now. People who don't support the president come up to me and say, the media is doing a huge disservice because we're normalizing the president. We're making this guy seem normal. I had a lady in the grocery store the other day excoriate me for referring to him as President Trump, you know, which is, of course, what he is. But, you know, but just the thought, the phrase President Trump, mm-hmm. just bothers her so much. But is there a danger, you know, in writing about what he does and what he says? I mean, his factual accuracy record is so deplorable, to borrow a phrase from Secretary Clinton. Are people writing and broadcasting about him making him more normal than he really is, Gene? I don't know.
People don't kind of understand that the media can't choose what they cover all the time. You know, he's the president. What he says is news. And we can't be in the position of saying, oh, I'm not going to cover that because he's obviously crazy. It's just a tweet. Well, that's how he communicates with the American public. You know, we can't not cover it. And I think, you know, the press has done a good job, I think, of sort of the in real time fact checking. You know, in the past, I think people would just say, oh, did you see what Trump tweeted today? And there would be this whole story. And then it would take a day or take another news cycle before, you know, PolitiFact or some fact checker would say, no, everything he said was a lie. So now, you know, you're seeing people saying Trump said X, and you'll have some parenthetical phrase going, which is totally contradicted by reality. So, I mean, it seems like that's the way you have to cover him. You know, yeah, you're the stenographer, but you're also the fact checker at the same time.
Gene Marbella of the Baltimore Sun, Alec McGillis of ProPublica. And speaking of fact checking, my crack staff has checked my facts, and I attributed your Pulitzer Prize team at the Baltimore Sun. It was, in fact, at the Washington Post.
Yes, although we did, I was actually, in fact, prouder of the finalist spot that we got at the Sun for our sniper coverage.
All right.
So that's fine. Thank you.
You can beam with as much yes. pride as you'd like, but I want to make sure that folks know that you won that Pulitzer at the Washington Post. It's the Midday News Wrap. You are welcome to join us when we come back after a quick break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. If you want to drop us a tweet, our handle is @MiddayTomHall. Stick around.
This is your public radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.
And welcome back to the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday, we're going to take a look at what's going on in the General Assembly. Rachel Bay from the WYPR reporting staff down in Annapolis and Aaron Cox from the Baltimore Sun will join me, and we'll get an update on what's cooking down there in Annapolis. If you've just joined us today, it is the Midday News Wrap. I'm joined here in Studio A by Jean Marbella. She's been a writer and editor at the Baltimore Sun for 30 years. She's currently on the Sun's investigative and enterprise team. Alec McGillis covers politics and government for ProPublica, is the author of The Cynic, a 2014 biography of Senator Mitch McConnell, and the winner of this year's Polk Award for National Reporting. You are welcome to weigh in and join our conversation. 410-662-8780 is our number here at Midday, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So, Gene Marbella, there's a Goucher poll earlier this week that shows that here in Maryland we are, to a certain extent, still living in a bubble,
right.
You know, that really doesn't have a whole lot to do with the kinds of folks that, Alec, you were writing about in the middle of the country. About a 29% approval rating for the president, which is a slightly higher than the approval rating for Congress, which among Marylanders sits at 21%. Mm. What kind of impact, I'm hesitant to use the word problem, but what kind of challenge might this continue to present for our very popular Republican governor, Larry Hogan?
Yeah, he sure is straddling a fine line. And, you know, Maryland has a tradition of, you know, producing moderate Republicans. But to get elected and reelected, you need Democrats to vote for you. And what's interesting to me about Trump's impact in Maryland is, you know, unlike any other previous president, I feel like everyone is being made to take a stand on him. You know, whether you're, Kevin Plank at Under Armour, or whether you're Governor Larry Hogan. And people are not going to be satisfied, I think, with someone who says, well, I didn't vote for him, but, you know, he's the president and, you know, we want to make sure we keep getting federal funds or whatever. People, I think, want to hear, you know, either a denunciation or it's just like, who are you with? You know, are you with us or against us? And it's, you know, I'm not sure how Hogan will play that, although he's so personally popular. When you see his approval ratings,
Upwards of 70%.
Yeah.
And one of the most popular governors in the country.
Yeah.
By far.
And I think, you know, it may not pose as much of a problem for him as it would another politician who doesn't have that personal connection with the voters that he appears to have.
Yeah. Alec Miglow's piece in the Times today about how Democrats are demanding a kind of Republican strategy, if you will, against Mr. Trump by saying, let's adopt the position and the strategy that the Republicans did against President Obama, which is be the party of no and just resist him at every turn. The DNC is meeting today and tomorrow in Atlanta to choose a new leader. Where do you think the grassroots of the Democrats are these days? Everybody has this notion that the Democrats are in complete disarray.
No, they are very energized, and the grassroots, and they are definitely heading in that direction of demanding just real almost total opposition and non-cooperation, which is tricky for Democratic elected officials because it comes a little bit less easily, less naturally to Democrats in power to be the party of obstruction and intransigence and sort of encouraging dysfunction than it did for, say, Mitch McConnell, because, you know, Democrats are the party that sort of believes more in government, believes in functioning government, and so it goes a little bit against their nature to be the party of obstruction, but I think that even Democrats in Washington who are somewhat more inclined toward cooperation, toward conciliation, are realizing this call from the grassroots to stand firm. And in some sense, it might become sort of a moot point for these Democrats in Washington because Trump has shown no sign of really reaching out yet for any kind of legislation, whether it's infrastructure or tax reform or something where there might be some room for conciliation and negotiation. So far, there's been nothing to actually work around. So it might actually be moot. What I'm interested to see is, coming back to Governor Hogan, is whether Democrats will start to do a better job, Democrats in Maryland will start to do a better job of tying Hogan to President Trump in specific ways. It's not just, oh, you're a Republican and so you're the party of Trump and you must disavow him. But there are actually specific things you could actually use to link them. For instance, there was this huge uprising just in the last couple of weeks against Trump's nominee for Education Secretary, Betsy DeVos. You know, big welling of uproar against her. And it was really quite remarkable to watch that. One of the things that
And generally because of her antipathy towards public education. And that is something that Mr. Hogan has weighed in on
exactly.
in this session. Yeah.
And his own budget is calling to double the amount of money that we are giving toward private and parochial school vouchers in the state. We now give $5 million a year toward private school vouchers. He wants to double that to $10 million. That's right out of the Betsy DeVos policy playbook. And I'm surprised that Democrats haven't done more here to make that link.
Alec McGillis from ProPublica, Gene Marbella from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to the Midday News Wrap, 410-662-8780. Our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Let's head to the phones. Jim on the Eastern Shore. Welcome to the News Wrap with Gene Marbella and Alec McGillis.
Thank you much. I had one big question and one little question just occurred to me. The big question is, how long will it take Trump supporters to find out either congressional inaction or because Trump actually passes what he wants to pass, that they're not getting anything from him? And how long will it take them then to turn on him, if they ever do, or will they stick with him irrationally? The second question is, we'll never see his tax forms because I think if Trump had to cash out, he would end up negative. His whole career has been highly leveraged. So tackle both of them.
All right. Thank you for the call, Jim. You know, this is a common thing. You know, he's bound to disappoint. You know, the coal miners in Kentucky aren't getting their jobs back. But right now, he's not talking, it seems to me, to anybody other than the people who voted for him. So, Gene, I mean, if he continues to campaign for the people who vote, the media is against you, you know, the bigwigs in Washington are against you, the left coast, the right coast are against you, but I'm with you. That it seems to me it's going to take a long time for people to be open to the idea of turning away from that.
Yeah. And, you know, one of his big promises was to repeal Obamacare. And yet, you know, his administration hasn't come up with any alternate plan. So it's kind of been left to Congress, you know, to face down all these voters at their town hall meetings. You know, I mean, I think already it looks like Obamacare is not going to be repealed wholesale. You know, there are 20 million people who would lose their health care, and whatever plans, vague plans are out there seem like you would get lesser health care for more money. So, I mean, I think that issue is just going to sort of drift away, and they're going to focus on whatever immigrants or whatever else plays to the base. But, you know, I just don't, you know, if people keep their health care, people who got Obamacare get to keep it, I think they're going to be okay. They're going to let Trump, you know, rail against the immigrants and, you know, maybe, you know, the consequences of that, I think, are going to be terrible long term, but maybe not necessarily in the short term. You know, there's this threat of mass deportation now. And so what's that going to mean, you know, to this caller on the Eastern Shore? What's that going to mean for the chicken farmers? What's that going to mean for the crab pickers? What's that going to mean in cities like Baltimore that, you know, have a pretty substantial, you know, core of immigrant workers?
Yeah, that's an interesting prediction that the Obamacare thing may just drift away. I'm not sure I see it that way. That's interesting.
Well, John Boehner, the former speaker, you know, came out at some speech recently and just said, listen, they'll be tweaking around the edges, but there's no way to repeal this and replace it.
Yeah, he said, you know? To that speech, he said, Republicans never agree on health care.
So they're going to have to, like, spin it somehow. Yeah. That, like, oh, yeah, we've changed it. It's no longer Obamacare, but...
Paul Ryan did release what he calls a policy brief and resources document. He released it last Thursday, which was the day of Mr. Trump's press conference. So, of course, it got completely gobbled up by that. But he says Obamacare has failed and we have a better way. And he promised to introduce actual legislation coming up sometime after the recess, which ends on Monday. I noticed at the gym this morning, I saw an ad on, I think it was MSNBC, call Congress and tell your representative you support the Republican plan to replace Obamacare. And I thought, well, there isn't a plan to replace Obamacare yet, but they're already buying ads for it. I mean, Alec, Obamacare is a thing that's, you know, serving as a lightning rod in an awful lot of town hall meetings, too.
It sure is. It's been extraordinary to see these meetings with some really dramatic scenes of people standing up in some pretty, you know, deep red states like Arkansas and Tennessee and making these very heartfelt, sort of emotionally charged testimonials to what the law has meant for them and their family. You know, places like Arkansas, which I think it was just last night or the night before, a big town hall meeting in Arkansas where Tom Cotton, the senator, was presented with a lot of angry people. Arkansas is tied for first in the country for the state that's had the most increase in coverage under this law. So what you're seeing is it's loss aversion. You know, get most energized by things that when they're about to lose them. And so that's why you saw the big uproar against Obamacare back when it was being passed, because people thought the law was somehow going to take something away from them, the status quo. They liked the status quo. Now this call for repeal means that you've got these 20 million, and actually, it's actually even more than that, people who are being helped by this law in some way, who are very, very upset about this. And Ryan's proposal that came out last week would, as vague as that proposal is, you can just see what kind of people it would hurt, and it would hurt a lot of people.
Jason in Baltimore, welcome to the News Wrap with Alec MacGillis and Gene Marbella.
Thank you for having me on.
Sure. What's on your mind today?
I'm a drama professor, sort of by profession, and I'm just curious if it were to ask you guys, with your mind, to take a look at this whole phenomenon, broadly defined, from a mythological perspective, because I feel like that's the only way I'd be able to get my fantasy, I suppose, through it in a way. Because I feel that what's happened is so fundamentally incoherent and fundamentally anti-American. And I'll leave you to jam on that, if you will.
All right, a mythological perspective. I don't know. It seems to me we got an awful lot of nuts and bolts perspective to apply to this. Notion. I mean, one of the things, Gene, it has to do with is this pounding of the president on the media. Does that matter? Does it matter that he's against the media? I mean, my attitude about this is, who cares?
Yeah. Well, again, I think a lot of people felt he crossed the line. You know, every president hates the media. And but he's gone as far as calling us the enemy of the people. So anything negative about him somehow, you know, gets extended to the American public. And, you know, that plays well with his base. But, yeah, when you look at, Alec and I were talking about this, when you look at the subscriptions to the New York Times, the contributions to ProPublica, you know, to all sorts of media outlets, they're up.
People are taking that as a form of activism. They're saying, right. If we support legacy journalism that's accurate and reliable.
Yeah, and cuts through the noise and the opinions and whatnot. And so I'm not sure who that, you know, how that helps him except with his base, which he doesn't need any help with.
Here's the president in Florida last Saturday.
I also want to speak to you without the filter of the fake news. The dishonest media, which has published one false story after another, with no sources, even though they pretend they have them, they make them up in many cases, they just don't want to report the truth, and they've been calling us wrong now for 2 years. They don't get it, but they're starting to get it. I can tell you that. They've become a big part of the problem. They are part of the corrupt system.
So, Alec Nicholas, we have an email from Julie who says, a question for Alec. Has he kept in touch with the Trump voters that he interviewed during the election to see how they feel about the potential loss of the Affordable Care Act, for example? Or have you kept in touch with them about their views of the media in general?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. I was actually just speaking with some folks in Ohio this week for another article I'm working on now, and they're people who depend very, very much on their Medicaid coverage from the Affordable Care Act, specifically for drug treatment, and I asked them, I said, you know, are you worried about losing your Medicaid? And almost to a person, when I put that question to people, they say, oh no, he told us he would make sure there was something else for us. He'll take care of it. There will be a replacement. There will be something that the notion that they would simply go completely without is to them sort of out of the question.
There is deep-seated trust in this president.
No, there really is. It's pretty extraordinary. And again, these include people who voted for Obama before. It's really remarkable to see that just that deep faith that he'll take care of them.
And Gene Marbella, if you're a person who has that kind of deep-seated trust in what this man says, I will get your job back, I will protect your Medicare, I will take care of your veterans, I have a secret plan for ISIS, the whole bunch of it. What has to happen for that voter to all of a sudden say, the president is incorrect, the New York Times, the Baltimore Sun, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal are reporting things correctly? You know, they aren't fake news. They are not uncredible. They are, in fact, trustworthy. Does it ever? I mean, what's the thing that tips the scale there?
That is an excellent question. And, you know, I think the thing is, as you know, as much bluster comes out of Trump, he still is, you know, the president is limited. Yeah, there are still, you know, funding formulas. He can't just kind of shift the budget here and there. So I think, you know, yeah, there's a lot of crazy talk now. But in the end, the world kind of keeps going on. There's a certain inertia, you know, government programs, you know, streets still get paved. And, you know, the doctor still sees you when you come in. So in the end, I think he doesn't have as much impact immediately as you might think. For people, you know, in Ohio who are, you know, living regular middle class lives, you know, but I think you know, Alec had brought up those immigration memos that came out earlier in the week, you know, how they were actually going to implement this. And it's such a radical change. You know, in the past, you had to be pretty much, you know, an illegal, undocumented person, and you had committed some violent crime. Well, now it's anyone who is undocumented. It could at any moment be deported. And if that, maybe that's just one of these empty threats that's out there. But if that starts happening, I mean, I just don't see how people stand for that. You know, already, you know, you go out and about in town, there are so many rumors of, like, don't go to that clinic because there's an ICE guy standing outside.
Kids not going to school.
Yeah, don't use that bus stop. I saw an ICE agent there and they'll get you. Don't go to, you know, this pharmacy. And there's this sort of, you know, people are going to go underground. And what does that mean? I mean, how does that impact, you know, do people stop showing up at work?
Yeah, but and of course, folks would also observe that there are laws.
Right.
I mean, the problem here is that these people are breaking the law.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we get to the point where the laws are such that what they're doing is not illegal, that's a different conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But until that law is changed or those laws are changed, then there's going to have to be some consideration, as you say, of the human impact of this. But the law is the law, and he's, you know, advertised himself as the law and order president. So this is, again, red meat for the people who voted for him, to be sure. We got to take a break, but we will be back with more of the Midday News Wrap with Alec McGillis of ProPublica and Gene Marbella of the Baltimore Sun. We got a few folks waiting online on the phone. We will do our best to get to you. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. As they say on SNL, stick around. We'll be right back.
This is your NPR News Station, member-supported 88.1 WYPR.
And it's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Alec McGillis covers politics and government for ProPublica. The articles he writes for ProPublica appear in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, and elsewhere. He's a former reporter for The Washington Post and The Baltimore Sun. He's here in Studio A along with Jean Marbella. She's been writing about Baltimore and other places for 30 years at The Baltimore Sun. She's a reporter on the Sun's investigative and enterprise team. Before that, she was a national correspondent and a columnist. Our number here to join the conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Frank in Aberdeen, welcome to the show with Gene Marbella and Alec McGillis.
Good afternoon. I would like you to discuss Trump using chaos as a tactic. Can you hear me?
Yep, I can. And this is something, Frank, that a lot of folks have suggested, Alec. They say that this is a modus operandi that is quite purposeful, that it's it's something that's not contrived. This is how he ran his business. This is how he's running the White House. He's got a guy like Steve Bannon, who's kind of the chaos king, at his right hand at all times. What do you think?
My sense of this has been all along that it's not so much tactical as it is his nature, and that this is just who he is, how he functions. And you know, you could come up with whatever kind of sort of diagnosis for that as you want to sort of try to make sense of it. For a guy like Bannon, it clearly is more strategic or tactical. Bannon is, you know, he's a bomb thrower. He's a troublemaker. He really sees himself as sort of a revolutionist, almost a Leninist, coming in to explode the system. As he said yesterday at the conservative convention down at National Harbor, he's gonna explode the administrative state. That was his word for it, deconstruct the administrative state. But for Trump himself, I really think this is just who he is, right? This is someone who spends his days watching TV, barely reading anything, and tweeting really, and just with not a reflective bone in his body, and it's just he functions on this level. So I think for him, it's not so much that there's some kind of goal he's trying to get to with these kind of tactics. It's just who he is.
But in terms of the messaging, and Mr. Trump is excellent at messaging. He's terrific. I mean, make America great again. You can look at that as a vacuous bit of blather, or you can make it. You could look at it as a very unifying, inspirational thing. It's like change we can believe in, you know, in years past. But Gene Marbella, they are worried about the media to some extent. There's a story that broke last night on CNN that's been confirmed by NBC News that Reince Priebus perhaps had some contact with senior officials at the FBI, asking them to help the administration tamp down or discredit a story in the New York Times about 10 days ago, saying that, you know, and of course, there's all sorts of questions about whether or not that's proper. Of course, it's not. We've got at the CPAC convention yesterday, Bannon making an appearance with Reince Priebus to disavow speculation that the two of them don't get along, that there are these two camps in the White House, that it's this chaotic thing. They're thinking about this stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, it's hard to, I agree with Alec that, you know, there may well not be some subtext. This may just be the text. This is who Trump is. And it's also kind of a useful distraction in many respects. You know, it's like, oh, you know, don't look at that man behind the curtain, you know, just look at the circus that's playing out. And so people are easily distracted these days, and it's like watching a reality show, and you realize, wait a minute, this is the government. You know, this is not a joke. This is not a circus.
Yeah. On 88.1, you're listening to the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall with Gene Marbella of the Baltimore Sun and Alec McGillis of ProPublica. Our number 410-662-8780, our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall, and our email midday@wipr.org. John in Baltimore, welcome to the show. Thanks for your call.
Thank you for having me. I would like to address the question of change that has been talked about in the panel, and how actually we face this present situation. Of course, we're dealing with language, and language in the latest decades has been coined as a relative way to access reality, and that has been somehow recovered by this movement that this present president enhances. And of course, it has also been taken by globalization, which is the real problem behind all of this. They are the do's and the don'ts of globalization. How can we talk about this person being the person of change? Change implies a radical alteration of reality. And actually what we are witnessing is a reaction to a certain reality which was there. When we talk about deportation, President Obama, was known about the deportation president. What is new, in fact? And how can we say that the Democrats are leading the changes when actually it's the grassroots movements in this country, back to the civil rights, which are spontaneously going to the airports and moving and going to those town halls and not saying what the actual president is saying, that they're being paid by other people. This is a real change, not the reaction that we are witnessing at the present moment.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, John. You put a lot out there on the table. I mean, the notion that the protests at town hall meetings have been paid for by some secretive liberal group has been pretty well debunked. I mean, I think this really is a grassroots movement, Alec. But I wonder, just in the big picture, I mean, back to our drama guy's mythological interpretation, is there a different notion of change in 2017 than there was in 2012 or 2008? Or is change always going to be change?
No, it's definitely as John said, more of a reaction, reactionary kind of effect that we're seeing in this country and elsewhere in Europe. You know, to the change that in Europe, it's really been more reaction to the change represented by these waves of refugees that they've been getting from Syria and the Middle East, and the fact that they are such such different kinds of change that Obama and Trump represented makes it all the more extraordinary, really, that you had people who voted for both of them. I mean, I think what it speaks to is that we're in an incredibly unsettled time right now, and it gets back to the fact that we've created this real this divergence of winners and losers in our economic system now. We have people who are just making out great in this new system of ours, this globalized system, kind of winner take all economic system. And then you have people in places that really are struggling and are resentful. And that's bubbling up all over the place here and elsewhere.
You've got therapists and counselors diagnosing what they're calling now post-election stress disorder, Jean Marbella, and they're actually, you know, it's going to be, you know, in a few years it'll be in the DSM or whatever. One of the fundamental reasons or perhaps explanations for how, for example, a candidate as divisive as Trump could win an election has to do with gerrymandering and the way the districts are conformed. Members of Congress and the Maryland congressional delegation have urged Governor Hogan to push for national redistricting reform. He doesn't want to do that. He wants to have redistricting reform, but only here in Maryland. Where do you think that's going to go, both in Maryland and perhaps around the country?
Well, you know, it's a really important issue, and unfortunately, it's totally political. You know, the reason Maryland is, you know, districted in the weird way it is because the Democrats have been in charge for so long and have carved out, you know, their little fiefdoms. And I think, you know, it's sort of like the filibuster rule. You know, you don't want to have filibustering if you're, you know, the guy that's going to lose in it. But then once you're in power, oh, that's fine. So, and you know, and I think what's really going to be important, I think, are the midterm elections. And the map right now is just terrible for the Democrats. You know, even though there's this grassroots effort to, like, you know, get Congress back in the hands of the Democrats, it's just because of the way the districts are, it, you know, the Democrats can't really gain that much in this election. But there's no real political will for national redistricting.
Alec McGillis, as we mentioned earlier, the Democrats are meeting in Atlanta this weekend to choose a new chair of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. Keith Ellison, the Muslim congressman from Minnesota, Tom Perez from Maryland, who was with the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department and then served in the Obama administration as labor secretary. And then there's that guy, Mayor Pete.
Yes,
I asked Stephanie Rawlings Blake last week how to pronounce his last name, you know, B-U-T-T-I-E-G.
And you probably forgot.
And no, she said Mayor Pete. So she knows the guy and can't pronounce his last name, but he's a young sort of millennial hipster mayor of South Bend, Indiana. Martin O'Malley, among others, have endorsed him. Where do you see the Democrats landing by Saturday night?
I really don't know. It's a pretty wide open race. It's been pretty extraordinary to see this, not just such a wide open race, but a really kind of high profile one. Usually races for party chairmanships don't get this kind of attention, and they've had someone kind of this big roadshow going around the country to in a lead up to this vote. You know, it has become kind of a allegorical thing of the Hillary Clinton camp versus the Bernie Sanders camp. I think it's actually a little more complicated than that. But there's this real sense that the party needs to find a new way forward, to rebuild from the bottom up. Mayor Pete is an interesting figure. He has his military background. He served in Iraq. He also came out as gay a couple years ago, which, you know, in Indiana was sort of a big deal. At the same time, he's also interesting because although he's from this Rust Belt town of South Bend, he's actually not very anti-free trade. He's actually sort of neoliberal on the trade stuff. So he's really kind of an unusual figure, and keep an eye on him.
All right, we just got a minute or so left. Jean Marbella, who's going to win Best Picture at the Oscars on Sunday night?
Oh, it appears La La Land is the conventional wisdom, but I think I keep hearing sort of a backlash to them. So
you never know.
Yeah,
you got a favorite, Alec?
Boy, you know, it was such a busy year for me last year that I barely got out. But I really loved Fences. So that's my
Fences too. Yeah. But yeah, unfortunately, the only movie I've seen other than that was Seabiscuit, and that was a long time ago. By the way, I want to mention that our snowfall tally here in Maryland is the lowest it's been in a long, long time. At 0.7 inches, we have less snowfall than the Sahara Desert this year here in Maryland. So just keep that in mind as you wander out for lunch in the 70-degree weather. Alec McGillis, Gene Marbella, thank you very much for coming by. I appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Gene Marbella is a reporter at the Baltimore Sun on their investigative and enterprise team. Alec McGillis is an award-winning reporter who covers, among other things, politics and government for ProPublica. That'll do it for this edition of the Midday News Wrap. Coming up on Monday, we're going to talk to WIPR's Rachel Bay and the Baltimore Sun's Aaron Cox, who covers Annapolis for the Sun. We're going to see what's cooking down in Annapolis and get an update on the General Assembly. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coghlan from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Charlie Hines provides production assistance. I'm Tom Hall. I appreciate your listening. Thanks very much. I look forward to being with you next week. Have a great weekend.